Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is Soundcheck at 93.9 WNYC and WNYC.org. I'm John Schaefer. The idea behind oral history could not be more straightforward. Get someone who has either made history or has been witness to it, sit them down, turn on the tape recorder, and just get them to tell their stories. Well, that is exactly what's been going on for over 30 years at the Oral History American Music Archive at Yale University. That's an extensive repository of audio and video materials, mostly consisting of interviews with major figures in the history of 20th century American music. The archive has just put out a remarkable new book with companion CDs called Composers' Voices, From Ives to Ellington. Joining us are the authors, Vivian Perlis, who is the archive's founding director. Vivian, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Libby Van Cleve, the associate director. Libby, welcome back to you as well.
Good to be here.
Now, the new book, I understand, Vivian, this is actually the first of four volumes that are planned?
Yes, that's correct. We don't think too much about the future volumes because this one has been a great effort. But many other people that we have represented in the oral history collection, we are eager to share with audiences, and we will do so as time goes by.
So, Libby, was the decision simply that it's time? We have, you know, such a critical mass of materials, and it's time to let people in on what we've been doing?
This has been an idea we've been enthusiastic about for a long, long time, and we just had to wait until the opportunity came up, frankly, financially. We had a funder who helped us being able to have the means to pursue this dream of ours.
What is the, I mean, basically, even in just this one volume with the two CDs, you've already gotten to a who's who of American composers of the 20th century. What is the value of these tapes in and of themselves? I mean, just, Vivian, you've been doing this for a long time. What do they add to our knowledge of American music?
Well, I'm glad you said add because we've always thought that the goal is to add to written documentation, not to replace it. But if you think about the telephone and the, what the telephone and the email has done to traditional correspondence, we don't have that. We won't have that in the future. And what it adds, what it can add, is a replacement for the for what we used to find in correspondence, but also a unique quality of the sound of a voice that can clue you in directly, spontaneously, and with an immediacy to the person, what the intentions and the thoughts and the feelings of a composer, sometimes more than the facts.
So with Beethoven and Mozart, we have their letters, you know, often voluminous correspondence, sometimes more than we wanted, frankly, to know about the composers. In the age of the telephone, that was disappearing, and so these oral histories are a way, as you say, of kind of getting to some of that material.
Yes, and it's using the technology, of course, that available when the tape recorder was invented, the possibilities of collecting and preserving the actual sound of the voice, and then, of course, videotapes take it a little bit further than that.
All right, now, Vivian, the last time you were here in our studios, we were talking about your own music. When did you start becoming an oral historian? How did you fall into this?
By chance, I would have to say. Both Libby and I come from the academic community, but we are both also part of the performing music world. I was a harpist for a long time. Mm-hmm. Libby is a very active oboist and particularly specializing in contemporary music. But are both of us closely connected with the world of contemporary music? And I came to this through the Yale Library having the collection of Charles Ives, and not only was interested in the music of Ives, but began to be very much involved with the papers and with the manuscripts. And I would say that oral history, our oral history project, and I'm sure Libby would agree about this, because some things get left behind, are not priority, but the priority is the urgency to collect the voice, the actual voices of people. And with Charles Ives, it was already secondary sources.
He was already talking to
a lot of people who knew and worked with him. And that's also the case with George Gershwin, who died so young. So the basic thrust came about through the urgent need to get to people while they were still with us.
All right. Well, now, you got to Lou Harrison before he passed away. And one of the things you talked to Lou Harrison about was, in fact, Charles Ives. Now, we're going to hear a couple of excerpts from the CDs that accompany the new book, Composers' Voices, From Ives to Ellington. Set these up for us. We'll hear them in fairly rapid succession. But is Lou Harrison and then a barber?
Yes. Libby and I both are very fond of what Lou Harrison has to say about Charles Ives. We also have a great deal of material with Lou about his own music. The range of the Ives Project, all the way from composers, Lou Harrison, Elliot Carter, Nicholas Leninsky, many of the composers, but all the way that intrigued me at the time to going to the barber shop in Bethel, Connecticut, to hear Babe the Barber talk about his
Babe
friend Charlie
barber.
Ives.
Oh, man, that's just...
Well, the point of it being Ives was an extraordinary personality, and people he knew were rather somewhat limited, but they all had something very special about them, as did Babe, as well as, of course, Harrison, very special.
All right, my guests are Vivian Perlis and Libby Van Cleave. They are the authors of Composers' Voices, From Ives to Ellington, and the founding and associate directors, respectively, of the Oral History American Music Archive at Yale University. Here are a couple of excerpts from that archive.
I think you must remember that my relation to him was profoundly reverent. Mm-hmm. It's an old-fashioned word, but it is that. When I went to meet him, the only images I could think of was that he looks like the images of God the Father as done by William Blake. And there's just no getting around. One could see through an alabaster skin, and the pulse of life in the very blood was literally there, visible to you, and the beautiful, bright, sharp eyes. And yes, he was old, of course, and there was a translucency in his very skin, but he did look like Blake, irradiated and suffused. And again, it was like a meeting with divine presence.
Well, now, there is no way you're going to get that out of a standard biography of the American composer Charles Ives. So now that's Lou Harrison, the late American composer, on Charles Ives. Now, for a vastly different kettle of fish, we dip into Babe the Barber talking about Charles Ives.
But one day I'll never forget. I had the apron over him, you know, and the radio was playing, and I pay no attention to the radio, you know, I'm cutting his hair, and all of a sudden, gee, like a shot out of a gun, he lifted up the apron like that, and he says, "Will you shut that damn thing off?" I'll never forget that. Well, has that got anything to do with him being a musician? Of course not. He didn't like what was being played. Well, I shut it off. I wasn't paying no attention to it at all, period.
All right, those are a couple of clips from the CDs that accompany the book, Composers' Voices, From Ives to Ellington. Vivian, when were those recorded?
They were over 30 years ago. I don't know exactly, but the early 70s. And they have lasted a long time. And, of course, some of the work that we do in the Oral History Project has to do not only with the wonderful interviewing of people, but with maintaining the materials. And Libby and I and other people who work in our office, we spent a lot of we try to keep up with what are the best methods for
storing and archiving.
Yes, it reaches in many directions.
Yeah, I mean, Libby, we know from sad experience here at WNYC that tape stock, especially in like the mid 70s and then again in the mid 80s, went through a period where it just wasn't very reliable. So I mean, are you guys constantly transferring tapes to digital formats and stuff?
Well, we've had a very substantial campaign. We were very fortunate to get support from the federal government, Save America's Treasures, funded through the National Endowment of the Arts and other a whole consortium of federal agencies gave us money. And interestingly, we are not only transferring things to digital formats, but we are transferring everything in our archive to good old tape stock, audio, analog, reel to reel tape. And so we have both media going.
All right.
And that's best for archiving.
Now, who does the interviews these days? Do you both do them?
We occasionally do them, and I still do some. I did in the early days. I did all
right.
did all of them. Libby has done a number of them, and particularly good ones too, because oral history as a method unto itself is one thing, but it has always seemed to us that it should be by people who are knowledgeable about the subject, and Libby knows so much about contemporary music performance. You mentioned when you sit down with a microphone and say, tell me about yourself. Many people, composers, don't want that. They want to know that you know what they're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And Libby and I both can talk to them in a way that speaks their own language. There's a great deal of research and preparation that goes into the interviews.
So, Libby, who did the interview with Vivian?
That would be me.
Right.
Sometimes I was going to say sometimes it's difficult because we're both so close with many of the subjects, and in this case, not only was I close with Vivian, but I knew the answer to quite a few of the questions before I asked them.
Uh-huh.
But we felt that it was useful to get these stories on tape, just like it's useful to get the composer's stories on tape.
Well, that was under a little bit of pressure. Libby had to convince me and to do the interview.
I'm still working on her.
Uh-huh. But you are now, Vivian, not only the founding director of the OHAM, as it's known, the Oral History American Music Project. You're now part of it. You're now in it, right?
Yes.
That history, that interview is there. Now, by the time you started this, you mentioned Charles Ives had already passed on. However, Ives is part. I mean, we do get to hear Ives' voice in the CD that accompanies the book. Tell us where this comes from.
Well, very briefly, it comes from, as a result of an interview with Mary Howard, who did recordings very early on. She was a recording engineer for NBC, and she recorded everyone from Milton Berle to Charles Ives, and people would come into her studio. And in the Yale Library, there were recordings that said Mary Howard recordings, but they couldn't be played. And I looked for Mary Howard in order to do an interview with her for about 2 years. And when I found her, as a result of that interview, and this is very true of a lot of interviews, the interview is interesting, but sometimes there's correspondence and manuscripts, music manuscripts. And in this case, the only sound of Charles Ives' voice, and that is Ives being recorded at the piano in Mary Howard's studio. And also the recordings of him playing many parts of the Concord Sonata and other pieces of music. So all of that was preserved, and we have it.
From her.
As a result of an interview, yes.
And when's this from?
When is it from? 1972.
But when's the recording? When was the recording made?
Oh, the recording in the early 50s.
Hmm. It's towards the end of
Ives'
yes. life. All right, let's. This is the man himself, the composer Charles Ives.
Nation, hooray, every honest country free to live his own native life. They will start for the right, but when it comes to might, they'll be there. You read their theme. And the people, not just politicians, the ruler own lands and rights.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. My guests are Vivian Perlis and Libby Van Cleve. They are the authors of the new book, Composers' Voices, From Ives to Ellington, published by Yale University Press, and an offshoot of their ongoing project called Oral History, American Music, an archive of oral histories. And Vivian, we heard that typically wild Charles Ives piece just before the break. Is that something you think that Ives would have wanted preserved?
No, probably not. He was a very, very private and individual, and people who knew him, people like John Kirkpatrick, for example, would often say how old-fashioned the Iveses were. And it's a dichotomy in, that he wrote music that was so far ahead of his time in so many ways, and yet they lived a very old-fashioned kind of life, and I don't think he would have wanted a tape recorder in front of him or...
And I should probably point out that, you know, for listeners who are not familiar with Charles Ives, that he, of all the American composers that have written music so far, not only was he one of the most influential in the music world, he was quite possibly the most, had the most impact on our lives as the father of the modern insurance industry in this country. So
that's
for the
true.
Second half of his life, that was his persona. He was the insurance magnate. And yes, a very prim and proper life for a man who wrote this wild and woolly music. But what we were just hearing coming out of the break was Ubi Blake. And Ubi Blake, you interviewed, I guess, when he was getting close to 90 years old.
Yes, he lived until 100,
but
I didn't know that at the time.
So you were feeling that urgency you were talking about
before. Yes, he was the last survivor of the original ragtime craze.
And was he willing to be interviewed?
Or? Oh, yes. Ubi was a performer at heart, and he loved it. He said, asked me what I was doing with that tape recorder, and I told him, and he said that, I said I wanted to hear his stories. Oh, he said, we call that passing it on down, passing it down to the young uns. And, actually, we've had that dedication in our book to... From him.
So you got him to talk about the origins of ragtime.
That's correct, yes. And about his background. His parents were slaves, and he had a great deal to say about not only his music, but his upbringing.
Well, let's hear a little bit from Ubi Blake. Now, this again, there are two CDs that come with the book called Composer's Voices from Ives to Ellington. This is the voice of ragtime great Ubi Blake.
Now, people ask me, where did the word ragtime come from? Well, I'll be 89 years old next month. And I don't know who. I don't know where it come from. First time I ever heard the word, I'm playing my music. Bass and all, see? And my mother stand like that. But my back to her, I don't know if she's in the house. Take that ragtime out of my house. Take it out of my house.
So Ubi Blake would talk about ragtime, but I understand, Vivian Perlis, that he wouldn't talk about jazz.
No, Ubi was clearly said that he was brought up a certain way, and that there were words that he wouldn't say in front of a lady, and one of them was jazz. It had certain connotations that he felt were not proper to say in front of a lady. He was truly a gentleman. That Ubi was also, he had so much fun. He was so much fun to be with, and he enjoyed music and performing, and did a television documentary on Ubi Blake when he was 97. He was still playing and singing and having a good time.
My guests are Vivian Perlis and Libby Van Cleave, the authors of Composer's Voices from Ives to Ellington. Libby, I mean, one of the things with oral histories is you're getting someone to tell their story. You're not, you know, it's not like a research paper where you're going to do a lot of fact-checking and challenging someone on assertions that they're making. But do you at times find that you need to kind of stop someone for a second to check on something or to challenge a statement? Does that ever happen?
Every so often, they might need a reminder about dates, something like that. If a subject is saying something that you know is very likely not quite the full truth or all of the truth or whatever, there are ways subtly to question them. Also, our procedures at the Oral History of American Music Project are to transcribe all of the interviews and then afterwards to give people a chance to review what they've said and make amendments if they need to. And that does happen sometimes.
Mm-hmm. With Aaron Copland, Vivian, when you interviewed him, I mean, I guess he must have been one of the first major figures that you went to for this project.
Yes, he was. He admired the Ives Project a great deal, and when it was clear that wanted to establish a project broader base than only the Ives oral history, turned first to Aaron Copland, who the preface to the book on Charles Ives that resulted from the interviews Charles Ives remembered. And that was very helpful to us at the time. And Copland liked the idea that you could have a biography of someone from a multi-level view from many different people.
Mm.
And so, of course, that's one kind of use of oral history with the Ives, with secondary sources. But Copland was the direction that we went, and that is directly with the living composer as much as we possibly could. So, of course, his stature in the world of music and his involvement in so many, many things and his own music led me to him very soon after the project was established on a broader basis.
Now, the thing with Copland was he was more than happy to talk about the state of American music and, you know, what could be done to improve the lot of American composers, et cetera, et cetera. My understanding, he was not very keen on talking about himself or his own personal life.
That's very true. I talked to him, and when you say interviews, it wasn't a one time, over a very long period of time, and a life history of Copland. He had a long life, and after all, lived to be 90. He would say, rarely use I, he would say, we composers, or one does. On the other hand, and so you would think he was quite modest, but he had a lot of confidence in what he was doing musically. He very rarely questioned who he was and what he was doing, in spite of the fact of his modest demeanor.
Well, I think we can hear a clip of Aaron Copland on the naming of his famous piece, Appalachian Spring.
Say that he's talking about his conversation with Martha Graham here, which is not in the clip.
Okay.
The ballet had no name. And, of course, the first thing I said to her when I saw her and the thing was finished, I said, what have you called the ballet? She said, Appalachian Spring. Oh, I said, what a nice name. Where'd you get it? She said, oh, well, it's the name of a poem by Hart Crane. I said, well, does your ballet action have anything to do with the poem? She said, no, I just like the title. But I can't tell you how many times people have come up to me and said, when I hear your score for Appalachian Spring, I just see the Appalachians and feel spring. They naturally assume I had that in mind when I was writing the work.
Well, one of the great things about oral history is you actually get to hear those primary sources, the composers themselves. In that case, it was Aaron Copland from one of the two CDs that accompanies the book, and a hefty book it is, called Composers' Voices, From Ives to Ellington. Vivian Perlis and Libby Van Cleave are the co-authors and running the archives there at Yale University. And Libby, it's an ongoing process, right?
For sure. We hope for a long, long time to come.
So you're getting contemporary composers these days. And All right. Good job, and obviously a job that goes on for generations, we hope, to come. Vivian Perlis, Libby Van Cleave, congratulations on a really fun book to read, in addition to being an important one. Thank you for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
And you can find out more about Oral History American Music, the project of the Yale Archives, on the Soundcheck page of WNYC.org. And that'll do it for Soundcheck today. Tomorrow on the program, The Musical Legacy of Bob Dylan. A recent documentary by director Martin Scorsese sheds some light on the singer's life and work. We'll talk about the film and the man behind the music and we'll take your calls. We'll also speak with singer-songwriter Robin Hitchcock about his love for Dylan's music. Soundcheck's technical director is Irene Trudell. Our producers are Allison Lichter and Brian Wise with Eileen Delahunty. Our executive producers are Chris Bannon and Elena Park. We had help from Patrick Rivers. Join us again at this time tomorrow for the next Soundcheck here at 93.9 WNYC.